exciting.
Welcome back to PDGA Radio, the second episode of February here in 2022. It's Grant Zellner and Jennifer Allen, and we're thrilled that you're joining us here as I stare out my winter at snow on the ground here in the South Central part of the United States. Jennifer, can I just move to Arizona and like sleep in your garage? Is that fine?
Our garage is actually a nice warm temperature, probably warmer than Oklahoma this weekend.
Can I bring the fam? We can all camp out. We're cool.
Okay, great. Of course. Yeah. I was going to say, can I brag that I was watching the news this morning and the weather, and they were bragging about how we're going to hit the 80s this week?
Stop it.
Can I brag about that or no?
Stop it. Really? Stop it. No, I was fortunate. I got to go out and play. For those listening that maybe aren't as familiar with the part of the United States where I hail from, we get really harsh winter storms, but our average winter temperatures are well above freezing. Our average daytime winter temperatures are typically in the 40s, I think. It's not uncommon to have temperatures in at least the 50s, but when a winter storm comes, it hits real hard, real fast, and for about 2 or 3 days, the world basically stops. It might sound like a bit of an overreaction to a lot of you.
No, but you guys get so much ice. It's so much ice usually than snow. So it does shut down. I will defend you on that, being from there. And my daughter's still living and was complaining of how it was 70. And then the next day was about to be
exactly
10.
That's so exactly what happened. So I went out, it was in the 60s. It was like 67, 68 degrees Fahrenheit. I went out and I beat the winter storm by playing, I'm trying to remember what afternoon this was. I want to say it was Wednesday-ish of last week.
Yeah.
And literally within a matter of hours of me getting off the course, the wind shifted. The precipitation started. The precipitation started freezing on everything. And they shut schools down preemptively. You know, that whole bit. And next thing we know, we've got snow drifts piled 3 feet high and more in some places. And we've got all kinds of drama happening because of that. So I'm looking out my window right now at the aftermath, because once again, it's already going to be back up near 60 degrees today. So the great thaw is on for my neck of the woods. But once again, over the weekend, I lived vicariously through you.
Most people were buying bread and like milk, and you were like, I got to get my last round in.
I know, right? Yeah. Going to the supermarket the day before a storm in this part of the country is kind of comical, honestly.
Yeah. It's so funny.
But anyway, how did you play over the weekend in your balmy conditions?
Well, again, it felt like Oklahoma, maybe even worse. This may have been the worst winds the strongest winds that I've ever played in, which is saying a lot because I've played in a lot of strong winds. But when you take 30 mile per hour winds and you put yourself on top of a mountain, it gets very brutal. Like,
no doubt about it.
I can throw the disc as hard as possible. And I was like, I don't know what's going to happen when I let this out of my hand, and literally was blowing the disc out of our hands. We were the funniest hole. And I actually did kind of record a little bit of it. It was not funny at the time, but it kind of was. We had this one of the longest holes played along the ridge of this mountain. I was in Lake Havasu, Arizona, which is known for it to be really windy.
Right.
And it does also not have a blade of grass on the entire course. So all dirt.
That's good on the discs.
Oh, my discs are destroyed. So, but we threw this hole, and it took me 3 shots along the bottom of the mountain because I blew off the mountain. So 3 shots to get to the basket, but 3 shots to also get into the basket. And how many discs we saw, even the Masters were playing in front of us, putting from 5 feet and blowing like 120 feet down the mountain.
Yep.
Like it would blow out of the basket and blow all the way down the mountain. Like,
yep.
Unreal. So we were crawling. We were throwing our disc along, you know, laying down basically on the ground and like throwing our feet like 10 feet at a time to try to get it into the basket. So very comical. Too bad that was not recorded and shared with all, but we played, we survived. We felt like we all deserved a medal to survive this weekend, but, great tournament. Graham puts on down there in Lake Havasu. It's actually a really pretty area. The lake is gorgeous. But we, I won. So nice. Another good weekend.
All right. Gearing up for the season. And by the way, we will be talking about other parts of the world here as the season progresses. You just have to forgive us a little bit of lamenting the winter conditions and frankly, our lack of real preparedness for them.
Right.
So by the way, super respect to all of those listening who are in parts of the world that deal with a much harsher winter than I do and have managed to, find really great ways to enjoy disc golf and things through those conditions to where to you, it's no big deal. It's like a Tuesday. It's, hey, I'm going out to play. I don't care that it's negative 30 degrees or whatever. And I think that is fantastic. So as the season goes on, Jen, and you and I begin to travel to events and some things like that, we'll definitely start to bring in a lot more attention and a lot more updates from different parts of the country. And who knows, maybe someday we'll get a little bit more global. And on that note, of the global nature of disc golf, we've been sitting on a question, Jen, you and I, that came in on our podcast email, which by the way is podcast@pdga.com. And I'm sure I'll repeat that here in a few moments. But it was a question from a European player named Magnus Carlsen. And Magnus was sharing some thoughts and some questions that he has about the PDGA's role in not only Europe, but around the globe, basically outside of, say, the United States and Canada. We'll just call it that. And we wanted to make sure that we answered this question right. And I think we've done that because we've brought in to the PDGA radio studio none other than Brian Henniger. He's the International Program Director of the PDGA. Well, Jennifer, we got a really interesting listener question just about 2 weeks ago, I think it was, to podcast@pdga.com, which is a great way to ask us questions that we just might address on the air. This came from Magnus Carlsen from Sweden, talking about the PDGA's role on an international level. And I think this is cool, Jen. He actually used Google Translate in order to send us this note.
That's awesome.
Which is really, really interesting. So I assume he wrote it in Swedish. I'm just going to read a couple of lines from it because the translate feature is still a little bit buggy. But here's some of what Magnus wrote to us. He wrote, "The feeling that I have is that everything the PDGA does is about United States related things when it comes to competitions, meetings, educations, even the podcast." He says, take Worlds as an example. It's a world championship, but it's always played in the United States. I love that he bothered to say this. He says, I'm not trying to be rude or anything. I'm thinking it's possible that the PDGA does much more than I understand. So he's genuinely asking how the PDGA works, being based in the North American continent, but as a global governing body. So those are a summary, again, of Magnus's thoughts, and I can't think of anyone better to address these thoughts. We have in-house with us right now Brian Henniger. He's the International Program Director for the PDGA, coming to us from, interestingly enough, outside the United States, from Toronto, Canada. Brian, how are you this morning?
I'm very well on this beautiful midwinter morning. How are you? How are Grant and Jen doing?
I'm warmer than you two, I'm sure.
Yes, it's we're having an above seasonal day today, which means it's going to be at about the freezing mark. And we got about a foot and a half of snow on the ground. Real, wow. Real winter right now.
I'm looking at snow out my window here in central Oklahoma. Of course, it'll be gone by the time we're done chatting this morning, I'm sure. Brian, a lot of people don't know you. They don't know your history with the PDGA. We've had such an influx of new membership over the past 18 months to 2 years that there's just a wonderful opportunity to go back and talk about some of the history of our organization. And you have been such a big part of that, beginning with, let's just start at the beginning, Brian. Your PDGA number is 4,022. You've been around for a really long time. Can you just talk about your introduction to disc golf and how you became a part of the PDGA?
Sure. Well, when I was a teenager in the 70s, my friends and I were Frisbee fanatics. We would just play throw and catch it different ways. We weren't freestylers or anything. We were just, you know, we'd go out in the street after school or after work and, you know, play across the main streets and in the parks and play throw, run and catch, try and do as much as we want, as much as we could that way. And in the early 80s, the first courses went in Toronto. One went on Toronto Island and one in Centennial Park in the western side of Toronto called Etobicoke. They were among the first 50 or so courses in the world to go in. And in 1982, my Frisbee playing friends discovered the island course and they brought me down to it. And I played it a couple times, really enjoyed it. And then a couple years later, I started to become fanatical when I played a bit more, bought my first golf discs, discovered a course in Vancouver, my tree planting summer, and so on. And then there was a guy on Toronto Island, my home course, called Michael Sullivan, who was one of the better players in the world at the time. And through playing with him and the other real keeners in Toronto, I learned there was a world championships. There was a professional disc golf association. And I was, when I heard that, I was just gaga. How cool is that? There's a players association. There's even a world championships. And I mean, of course, the game was about a 50th of the size that it is now. So my wife and I were working overseas at the time in international humanitarian assistance, but I would come home every May or June for 5 or 6 weeks. And I'd just go run around the disc golf course all day long, all month long, play a few events and so on. And then when we came home finally, once and for good in 1990, I became, sort of a semi-touring pro, if you will.
Right.
Which means we'd go work all week and then we'd go drive a few hundred miles on Friday to play in a big event, 500 miles to Cincinnati or 300 miles to Ann Arbor, 350 miles to Pittsburgh, a couple hundred miles to Rochester. That's what we would do. And I was a board member for the PDJ a couple of times in the mid-1990s. And in the end of 1996, when I knew the then administrator was coming to the end of her tenure, I fought hard to get the job. The job then was called administrator. The PDJ only had one employee, and their job was basically to ensure that everybody got their memberships and everybody's results were typed into the database. Then there was no uploading of spreadsheets or, massive upload of data from Disc Golf Scene that set you up for your tournament. You literally banged in every keystroke.
Wow.
There were handwritten TD reports, and the database started in about 1994. A gentleman called Doug Thies and Indiana designed it initially. This was an MS-DOS database. And when I took over from this lady, Becky Powell, at the beginning of 1997 as PDJ administrator, I inherited her desktop, a bunch of boxes of magazines, a bunch of boxes of directories, a bunch of boxes of new member discs and minis. And she worked out of one room in a little cow town west of Fort Worth called Weatherford. And I went down there, got trained. Then we loaded all the stuff into a semi that had Ontario license plates on it. And I picked the stuff up in the outskirts of Toronto about 5 days later, drove it over to Toronto Island and ran the PDJ here together with my wife from the very room I'm speaking to you in.
Wow.
This was the PDJ office, this room from 1997 to 2004 when we moved to Georgia and the International Development Center program kicked off.
Wow.
So briefly, the PDGA was headquartered not in the United States. It was headquartered in Canada.
For a period, during my first years of my tenure, yes, as a Canadian. Yeah.
That's fantastic. What were some of those early initiatives that you worked on during that time? I understand the rating system came along.
The rating system, two or three years later, we got one of the most dynamic boards of directors the organization has ever had. There were just some go-getters on the board. Teo Pozzi was a board member who was leading the development of IT that led to PDB, PDJ database, the next iteration of the database that you would have all known through the years 2000. Let's see. I mean, the main thing that we did is, at the office was PDJ had had a bit of a rough time through the 90s. There was one administrator who had basically dropped the ball and left the PDJ with no money, and it wasn't fulfilling, you know, the services it was it had promised to his members. This lady, Becky Powell, who I mentioned, and John Houck, who was a name known to many of us. He was then president of the PDJ. They basically put the PDJ back on its feet in the 2 years that Becky was leading it, which was 95 and 96. And what I inherited at the beginning of 97 is I inherited $50,000 in the bank and those, you know, the modest resources that I mentioned, the desktop and the boxes of fulfillment materials. So the big thing that we really did was we gave the PDJ stability that it hadn't had before, and we made sure that the service that they were the basic service, so the membership event player results system, was functioning the best that it could. So everybody's results were being banged in as quickly as we got them, and everybody's membership was going out the door as quickly as we could get it out the door.
Mm-hmm.
And that gave, you know, what that did is that gave the membership a sense that the PDJ is more reliable than ever, and it gave us the grounding to be able to move the organization forward. The rating system, of course, is one of the all-time additions to the sport and member benefits. It has been cited, for example, by the international countries as the single largest reason when we started the international program about 15 years ago that so many people decided to sign on and join. To the point, I mean, in 2005, the first year that we did it, we had about 200 international members outside of USA and Canada. And here we are 14 years later, and we had about 17,000 last year.
Wow.
Which was the entire size of the organization circa 2009, 17,000 current members. Now we have 17,000 outside of USA and Canada.
Growth for sure. Now, when did your tenure as executive director end, and what have you been doing since then?
Right. So in 2002, I was promoted to become the first executive director of the organization. We were applying for our visas to go work in the United States by then. It took 3 goes in 1 year to get what was called an L1A visa for me, which is an executive transfer visa. And that the beautiful thing about that kind of visa is it comes with full working privileges for the accompanying spouse. So the accompanying spouse, my wife, was the memberships manager, which was basically a glorified office or secretarial type position.
Mm-hmm.
So she's not going to get a visa by herself to work in the USA for that level of work, at least on paper. But this type of the visa that I got allowed her to come with me. So in we moved to the States in April 2005. And we finished at the end of May 2007, a month after the International Disc Golf Center was opened. So, and Brian Graham had been hired as my replacement by that time. Part of the reason we went back to Canada, well, there were a couple of reasons. One was we had worked for the PDJ full time for 11 or 12 years. It was pretty intense work. As the organization grew. And the second thing is where we live in Toronto is unique. We live on Toronto Island, and there's a long history, a unique history of legislation safeguarding the community here. And briefly, if I'm away from my house for more than 3 years, I lose my house. And we would never be able to recover it because there's 700 of us who live 1 kilometer offshore from Toronto's skyscrapers, and there's 6 million people on the other side of the water.
And so. Suddenly I want to come visit.
I know. That's what I was going to say. Grant, let's go record our show with
you. Yeah. Well, there's, you know, there is a pretty cool disc golf course on the islands. It was host to the 1987 World Championships. Yeah.
We'd have everything we need, Jen.
Yeah. I'm ready to go back.
So since that time, though, your involvement maybe fluctuated somewhat with the PDGA, but it certainly never ceased.
No, when we moved back to Canada, the chair of the board circa 2005, a gentleman from Texas called Dave Nesbitt, and I together designed the international program in theory in 2004-2005, and then it was launched in 2005-2006. And when I handed over the executive directorship to Brian Graham, I became the international director, who's also responsible for Canada. So I was responsible for PDGA programming outside of its traditional base in the USA. And, you know, we were starting with basically what was a fledgling program. The international program took off for a few reasons. We're going to get into the pricing dimension of PDJ International, which is one of the answers to mm-hmm. our friends Magnus in Sweden. But the other reasons were, I mean, we had met the best international players every year at the World Championships. We would go to the Japan Open. There would be a few people who would go to Europe every summer or so for a couple of events, but there wasn't a lot of interaction or effort being put into the internationalization of the sport and its organization. So that was the idea behind the development of the international program. The PDJ already wrote the rules, did the technical standards, owned and organized the World Championships. Those are roles of the governing body of a sport. So even though we were based in the US, had done very little outside of the USA and Canada, we were still, by virtue of the roles we were playing, the global governing body of the sport. So we had obligations as our capabilities increased to reach out internationally and try and do what we could in our organizational role at the center of the sport to introduce the sport into more countries and to introduce the PDJ and to get the PDJ brand active in more countries, which was one of the other goals of the international program, continuing to build the brand.
Sure. And with that, we began to sort of segue back into some of Magnus's questions and observations. Yeah. And I appreciate his openness. He wants to learn exactly what we're doing. I know that, for example, your role in leading the international programs had been, correct me if I'm wrong, more or less a part-time role for a time, and is now becoming and has become a full-time role. Or is that, am I stating that accurately?
No, that's completely correct. When I went back to Canada, I had I had another job offer, and I did both the jobs half-time, managed to balance them for a number of years, but with the incredible growth of the sport the last 18 to 24 months, it became apparent to me that I could not balance both jobs anymore. Joe Shargwalaf, the executive director, had approached me about, you know, considering going back to full time for PDJ, and I agreed to about 3 months ago, and I started full time again on January the 1st of this year.
Okay.
Yep. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you. I've never left because, and I mean, this is as unbelievable it sounds, this is now year 26, but it doesn't seem that long ago that I got the phone call, you've been hired as PDJ administrator. At that time, we were issuing member number 12,000. Now we're issuing what? 212,000. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Okay, Magnus. Well, clearly the momentum is building and has been building for quite some time with regard to the PDGA's international role. As you stated, Brian, there's always been a role, maybe worth more credit than some have given it as far as what the PDGA does as the governing body globally. But now some very specific things are beginning to happen. What can you tell us about the mission of the international program?
Well, the mission of the organization as a whole is to grow the sport both as a competitive sport and as a recreational activity around the world. So that has, you know, direct implications for activities outside of where the sport is already well established, countries like USA, Finland, Canada, Australia, and so on. There's another 200 countries out there that are slowly but surely becoming involved in our cool little emerging sport. Let me seg for a bit and give a direct answer to some of Magnus's positions. So, great. Magnus, why does it appear that the PDJ is primarily focused on the USA? Well, we are trying to focus more and more so on the other countries. It used to be 15 years ago that the PDJ was about 95% USA. It's now about 80% USA, but we had gone down into the upper 70s. Now the overall portion of the sport that's in USA has risen again. That's because of the incredible growth everywhere, but above all in the USA the last 2 months. I mean, it's just gone kaboom in the USA. You just have to look at the growth numbers. We went from something like, Vic can correct me if I'm wrong, but something like 57,000 current members in USA 2 years ago to 88,000 last year. That's growth of close to 60% in 1 year in the 45th year of an organization's history. That is unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. Really unheard of.
And it also meant that, you know, the PDJ has been spending an awful lot of time and resources that same period of time trying to play catch up and adjust its own and grow its own structure so it can handle this new level of expectation. But to go back to what I was saying, there are three key reasons for Magnus's perception. First of all, in the USA, this is very key. In the USA, the PDJ is both the national and the international association.
Mm-hmm.
In Magnus's country, Sweden, and in the other countries that we work with around the world, we are only the international association. The national association is performing a lot of the roles that the PDJ performs in USA. So in Sweden, we are talking about the Svenska Frisbeeförbundet. And, you know, we can talk about that is the organization that is responsible for organizing the national schedule in Sweden, its national series of A-tier events, the membership system within Sweden, helping to build courses in Sweden, and so on. That is the role of that organization.
Mm-hmm.
So the first one is that there is a difference in the roles that PDJ plays in USA and Canada, its traditional base, and what it plays in these other countries around the world where it partners with these national associations. And another, a key component why the international program has been successful to date in terms of its growth numbers, number of events, number of members overseas, is that a key tenet of the program is the national associations are in charge of their domestic affairs. So they are in charge of determining which tournaments are sanctioned, what is an A, B, or C tournament in their country? What membership obligations are there? What other support the National Association provides to its member clubs and individual members? That's the first thing. The second thing goes to finances. An international membership does not cost as much as a USA or Canada membership.
Mm-hmm.
USA and Canada are 75 US for pros and 50 for amateurs. International memberships are only 30 for pros and 20 for amateurs. Why? One reason is the international membership does not automatically come with the magazine because, you know, a lot of our members in Japan do not speak English or read English. So the magazine doesn't have that much use to them. But the difference in the prices, the cost for PDJ to get a membership, to get a magazine in Jennifer's mailbox in USA does not account for the difference in prices. So The PDJ has more money to work with from each USA membership than it does from each international membership.
Mm-hmm.
And thirdly, there has almost since the inception of the PDJ, there has been a tournament fees structure in USA and Canada, whereby at C tiers, you're paying, the players are paying $2 a head. At B tiers, it's $3. At E tiers, it's $4. Plus, this year, it's now only at C tiers. But if you're not a current member and you're playing in an event, it's an extra $10 bill that you have to send to the PDJ. Those fees are not charged outside of USA and Canada. And those fees account for more than $1 million in PDJ's income every year. So that is another reason why it appears that the PDJ is providing the bulk of its services within the USA. Well, we've got 80% of members are in USA. USA and Canada members pay more higher membership fees and also pay per event fees.
Mm-hmm.
Another reason why we don't have those fees internationally is, again, nowhere is the sport as monetized as it is in the USA. There is not as much money or the vision to have as much money in the sport as they have in USA. A lot of Europeans will talk about the more Olympic model of the sport in their countries, which was all about being a great competitor and having the skills more so than can I be a professional and earn my living playing this game.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some cultural difference as well in the approach to the sport. And that also affects the, you know, the relative stage of growth of the sport. In another 10 years from now, I'm sure Finland financially, in terms of the, you know, the monetary value of the tournaments, will probably look similar to what USA looks like today. There's few other countries who can, you know, chase that kind of scenario. The sport is much more humble, much more at the grassroots level still in most of the countries where the sport is being played. The USA is by far the leading edge of the sport, and so all of our perception and bias of the sport is going to be conditioned by, mm-hmm. you know, what I've just described as the reality of money and volume of people playing the sport. That's the result. Now, there are other reasons for Magnus's perception. He asked the question, why are the Worlds always in USA? Well, first of all, there's a bidding system for the Worlds. So we have to get bids from outside of USA further to even be the possibility of a Worlds outside of USA. My understanding is there was a bid from Europe for the Pro Worlds from Sweden about 4 years ago, but that bid was withdrawn not long thereafter because there are some extra challenges running a big level sports event with a payout in Sweden. There are a lot of tax obligations and obligations to the government mm-hmm. that would use up a lot of the money in the running of the event. So that was one reason. Now we are hoping to have a world championships in a Northern European country within the next 2 to 3 years. I won't tell you who that is. I'll leave that to your imagination. There are some challenges with the courses that would be used because one of them is vulnerable to other priorities of the city where it is based. But fingers are crossed, we will be able to have a first pro MPO, FPO Worlds in Europe with, you know, by the middle of this decade.
Okay. Well, now going back to something you said about some of the financial implications and why there might be a perception that the PDGA is more focused on North America, let's say, generally. You mentioned that members in United States and Canada pay more. Is it safe to say that because the money originates here, the money in a certain respect sort of stays here for projects here? And is that an emphasis moving forward for other countries that the monies spent by those members, preferably perhaps paying fees to their national organization, and then that way that money can stay there in their communities, growing the sport of disc golf?
Yeah, no, it's a very good question, Grant. And the fact of the matter is, you know, it has to be within the broader interest, it has to be a balancing act. Now, if we were weren't trying to do everything we can in the U.S. I mean, look at the partnership with Jeff Spring and the Disc Golf Pro Tour. Then the Americans would say, "Where are the, you know, what are you doing with all of our money?" The fact of the matter is, we all love the sport. We all want the sport to grow. The PDGA is the global governing body. Ergo, it must invest in the introduction and the development of the sport in parts of the world where that has not yet happened yet, or where that is in its infancy. At the same time, you can't say, well, we're going to do everything we can possibly in Europe, even if it's going to cost us three times as much money as all the income that we're receiving from Europe and the expenses that we have against that. Because we have, you know, every European member receives a member package. Well, getting that membership package into that person's postbox in Europe costs some money. If 10% of the membership is European and it's closer to 15%, then, you know, something in the range of 10% of certain profound USA office costs have to be considered as offsetting income from Europe. For example, the amount of the database that is dedicated to European members and events, the amount of the time that people like Big Dog, the tour manager, Vic, the membership manager, spend dealing with customers who are outside of USA and Canada, you know, which is a fair bit. And then there is, of course, you know, we have a young but growing program based in Europe now. We have two employees. The main single activity for PDJ Europe, the number one activity, is the delivery of the Euro Tour Series. We have another activity that is starting this year called the PDJ Europe Disc Golf Development Fund. What we're doing there is we're separating it from the Marco Polo program. And the reason for that is the Marco Polo program is the grant program we have for supporting initiatives in new countries. So, but we're going to do a different program for Europe because we want it to be managed by the staff in Europe. And it's all about the impressions that this gives to people like Magnus. If Magnus says, wow, PDJ is introducing a development fund for new courses, women's play, juniors play, new countries in Europe, and it's being managed by Europe, then they're investing our money that we give them directly back into Europe. Here's something we can see them doing directly with our money back into Europe. So that's why we're doing it that way. The Marco Polo program is managed by me and Brian Graham and Michael Downs at headquarters. Mm-hmm. So the perception there is that it's coming from USA. So this is the way, you know, these are the subtle ways in which you get Europe thinking that PDJ is doing more directly for Europe. The Euro Tour Series, the reason why I say it is the single biggest thing we do for Europe is because, again, it goes back to the roles of PDJ. In the European countries, each one of these countries has a national association. And that means that, you know, the gap that is there for PDJ to step into and work from is as continental body. So it means activities that can impact the continent as a whole. Are where the role of PDJ is in Europe has the most chance to impact. So, and the obvious thing there is the first most obvious thing there is the continental series of leading events called the Euro Tour. Now, Magnus will say, well, I haven't been exposed to the Euro Tour the last 2 years. And that's, you know, another thing that has put, you know, set back PDJ Europe a little bit in what it had hoped to achieve by now. unlike USA, where the DGPT was able to run both of the last 2 years and the national tour was able to run in 2021, the Euro Tour Series was not able to run either of those years because of the impact of the pandemic and the fact that, unlike USA, where we're talking different states, here we're talking different nations with different borders, and every one of them has its own COVID protocols as well. Of course, the U.S. does, but I mean, if I want to cross from Missouri to Kansas tomorrow, I'm just going to drive on the interstate, whereas crossing an international border in Europe during the pandemic is a lot more challenging.
Of course.
Yeah.
Well, Brian, what can we talk about now if we haven't already gone to it in terms of international plans for 2022 and beyond? You mentioned the hope of a Worlds coming along in Europe. Are to these specific plans in Europe or perhaps other parts of the world, Asia, Oceania, perhaps Latin America or Africa? Are there other areas of focus where you can talk about some specific plans in the works?
Sure, sure. In terms of the other countries in the world, Australia and New Zealand have been like USA, Canada during the pandemic. The game there has basically doubled in size the last 2 years. Now Australia and New Zealand have their own version of splendid isolation. They are, you know, many thousands of miles from the other continents. And it was only, I think, on the weekend that on CBC News, it said that New Zealand is finally going to open its borders to tourists in August of this year after they were closed for 2.5 years. Now, you want to talk about hard lockdowns. Those parts of the world really tried to keep COVID at bay, and New Zealand really succeeded. They still have hardly any cases because they are a relatively small, you know, two islands, whereas Australia, Omicron has hit it hard. But those, on the whole, those places are doing well. And I think in terms of what can PDJ do for there, I mean, we're looking with Brian Graham coming on board as a number two to Joe Shargwalef and now my partner and supervisor, you know, we are going to be reviewing a lot of the programs this year and seeing where we can have more impact. But in terms of Australia and New Zealand, and given that they're among the leading countries for disc golf in the world, I mean, you know, it's more, I think in their case, it's more a question of we ask them, listen, folks, is there something, one thing in particular that you can identify that we can do specifically to help your countries, given the situation those countries are facing, which is not the same situation as other continents in the world. Southeast and Eastern Asia had been the new little hotbed area the years leading up to COVID. We had that nice Southeast Asia swing tour with the first events ever in Singapore and Malaysia. And that little tour would climax with the Samui Swine on Koh Samui, which just happened this past weekend. Except 3 and 4 years ago, it was an A tier, and we had a handful of touring pros going there from the States and from Europe. Mm-hmm. Well, it was a hell of a lot harder to get there this year. And so it's a C tier event with, you know, half as many people as they would have in the big years. And, you know, the growth that we had in East and Southeast Asia has been stagnated by the pandemic, which is still hitting that part of the world hard, and still that part of the world is still largely closed. So, I mean, what can we do there is we can hopefully, once things open, we can help them get back to where they were and go a step further. One thing that's a possible development in the coming years is there is a real Asian championship featuring all the best players from different countries in Asia coming together wherever, perhaps Japan, perhaps the People's Republic of China, where the sport is starting to grow. Beyond that, Africa, where I worked for many years in a different job. Africa is there's some dots on the map, but sure, it's a long ways between the dots. There's a wonderful group in southern Zambia associated with the Eagle Wings Initiative. There is a more organized than ever small community in South Africa who have gotten a course in each of the biggest cities in that country now. There is our friend Johannes in Ethiopia, the social media genius, but his country is embroiled in civil conflict right now, and so there's not as much going on there as there would be. So in a roundabout way, I've brought us to Latin America, and when you want to talk about opportunities for the next few years ahead, this is the area that has been underdeveloped or undeveloped so far, but is, you know, given its proximity to the USA, especially Mexico, it has been logical to think for a few years that this is the next area of growth. And that is now starting to happen. There's a growing community in Colombia. There's a growing, last year we went from 15 to 50 current members in Mexico. They've also held their first PDJ events the last 1 or 2 years, as has Colombia.
Mm-hmm.
There's a group of transplanted Americans on the beach in Belize with 2 or 3 courses there. They were featured, I think, in the last magazine. There is a gentleman in Chile who is going to get a Marco Polo grant for the first course in the capital city there, Santiago. I've just asked him for a couple more pieces of information, and then we're going to approve a Marco Polo grant for them. So, you know, in my opinion, then you have the Paul Macbeth Foundation and Paul's family's ties to Latin America also fostering the introduction and initial development of the sport in a few locales. He's been in Guatemala. He's also been in Colombia, and he's been in Baja California. So in my opinion, every place is different. I mean, in Latin America, the crime is a little higher. Courses are going to have to be in gated places to prevent theft of the hardware, probably. I hate to say it, but it is a reality. And the other thing is that there's, of course, much of Latin America is, you know, at best, our best middle-income countries. And there are, you know, large swaths of their population that are fairly poor. So it's gonna be a different model of support that is gonna foster development there. I mean, it's, you know, another challenge with the internationals is, where does all the equipment come from? The baskets typically need to be made locally because the shipping costs from USA or China or Europe are substantial. And then you may also be dealing with customs duty when the baskets arrive. And in a lot of these places where the sport is just starting, the way the discs get there is somebody is traveling from the USA to that country and they bring a duffel bag full of discs. So these are some of the, you know, these are some of the hurdles that you have to overcome to grow the sport in a new country. And of course, beyond that, the big one for our sport is you have to be able to get the land to put in a permanent course. And, you know, 15, 20 acres for a 9-hole course, or 30, 40 for an 18-hole course, that is a wonderful mm-hmm. resource to have. Those pieces of land do not grow on trees. Ha ha ha. But so that's, you know, that is why, for example, it's one of the main reasons why Ultimate is played in a lot more countries than disc golf, because Ultimate, you need a lid and you need a soccer field. And so you want to talk about a low cost of entry sport. Wow. I don't know if it gets any cheaper than Ultimate, and that's to their credit. But, you know, we talk about disc golf being, hey, a disc golf course costs you less than a tennis court or a basketball court, but it does use a bunch of land that needs to be found.
Sure.
Over to you.
That's been wonderful, Brian. I was just going to ask you if there's any direction we haven't gone in yet that you just want to take advantage of the situation to be able to share with our listeners, which of course constitute PDGA membership at large.
Well, I want to put one out there to Magnus and all the other folk in Europe. I mean, we are trying to build PDGA in Europe, but for this to succeed and really be impactful over the long term, it requires buy-in from Europe. I mean, there is a voluntary board of directors. It's a young organization. They are Europeans who are on the board of directors. We have two young staff there, a Finnish gentleman called Kali Vainikka, who's the administrator. And I think many of the listeners already have heard my Tej Virl's name. He is the Europe tour manager. So it's a small but growing team. And we need, you know, when the elections for the board come up this summer, we need more good candidates for the European board, because these are the people who are going to help me and the staff in Europe move Europe forward. But we can't do it unless there is buy-in and support from Europe itself.
That's a key point and probably a great way to sort of wrap things up. Well, Brian, we can't thank you enough. This has been not only educational, but somewhat entertaining. And I think our listeners are going to enjoy hearing about a lot of things that I think a tremendous percentage of our listeners just have never heard these stories before. So credit to you and thank you for coming on.
My pleasure. And of course, it's the case with the amazing growth. I mean, you know, member number 100,000 was like 3-4 years ago. All of those people, their impression of the sport is, you know, the last 3 or 4 years. So they don't know where it's come from. I mean, I know what Jen's number is in the ballpark. She's been around for about 30 years. So she's seen
20.
she's seen a lot more than, you know, the lion's share of the members have. And the other thing, folks, and I'm saying this to everyone out there, is, you know, the PDJ realizes it can do a better job internationally, particularly with some of its communication. So we've had some meetings recently. We had a big summit in Augusta, Georgia recently, where we discussed the core competencies of memberships and events. We realize we can do more, but one of the key things we can probably do is we can communicate more and we can communicate better. So that's going to be some of the efforts over the short to medium term that hopefully will change, will get people with a more accurate perception of everything the PDJ does and why. And it's not going to be perfect for everybody, but hopefully, you know, people will have the impression that, hey, these are good people who are doing good work for developing the sport. Thanks.
So for Magnus, the takeaway is there's a lot to be expected, and there's also at least a little that somebody like Magnus might be able to do to get involved. And that's always a great thing. Once again, Brian, thank you so much for coming on and joining us today.
My pleasure.
Our PDGA news updates for the week of February 8th. If you haven't seen it already, perhaps over the course of the weekend, you got to check out PDGA Live. It's been updated and it looks fantastic. By the way, this is the platform that you would use if you're trying to follow along with an event, maybe that a friend or a pro or somebody is playing in. This is that platform where you can watch hole by hole as scores update. It's also the platform that you yourself might use if you want to share how you did an event with your friends, say on social media. This platform looks fantastic.
Yeah, the graphics are really neat. I definitely will be sharing mine a lot.
Well, it looks great. I got a chance to interact with it a little bit over the weekend because of an event that I was following. And At first I was taken aback. I didn't expect such a sort of aesthetically pleasing kind of a change.
Yeah, it really does look good. It looks very professional. Really cool. And I love how it has the rating. Like everything you need to know is right there on that screen. So it is really neat.
So if you haven't yet, check it out. PDGA Live has been upgraded, and it's very, very cool. Am I allowed to sing a song if I do it out of key enough? There's not a copyright infringement right?
I don't think anyone could tell what that was going to be. I was going to say I was bummed I didn't get to watch much Olympics this week because I played in another event. But did you get to see some of our fellow golfers are participating?
I have seen a little bit of the Olympics, and it turns out I just missed, like literally by moments, a chance to see one of our fellow PDGA members that is competing right now in the Winter Olympics in China. You have a couple of them there in front of you, Jen. Tell us about one of them.
So Oscar Erickson, PDGA number 189658, is competing for Sweden curling. He is about to compete for the mixed doubles bronze medal match against Great Britain.
Oh, that's cool. And he's probably not done. He's probably got other curling events.
Yeah.
The Olympics are what, 2 weeks long? 2.5 weeks long? They're really long.
Yes.
So we're just on what, the first weekend we've just finished. So he's got lots and lots of competition to go, but a chance at a medal already. How cool is that? So go Oscar.
It's so cool.
I'm going to wave the Swedish flag for curling here. And then another person who I just missed getting to see. I was watching TV and unbeknownst must have turned away or gone and done something else just before Michael Marinaro. By the way, he's PDGA number 179700. He's a Canadian figure skater. He's actually a pairs figure skater. And he and his partner skated over the weekend in this team competition that they're doing. So lots and lots of different figure skating members, I guess, in different disciplines all took the ice and they did some kind of a points system, right?
Correct.
Well, Canada.
I actually watched this.
So I missed getting to see he and his partner compete just by minutes. But the fact of the matter is Canada finished fourth. Just outside the podium, just outside getting a medal. But once again, I'm sure Michael may not be done yet competing because there are a myriad of other figure skating events going on right. for the rest of the week. So Michael and his partner will get a chance to get back out on the ice, I hope, and continue to compete for the chance at a medal. Now, listen, these are two members of the PDGA that we became aware of late last week. And basically what happened is we found out about one of them. We put him up on social media. It was Oscar, I think, that we found out about first. And somebody replied to us within a couple of hours and said, oh, this competitor also is a PD. So it wouldn't surprise me if there are more out there. So if you know, if you're listening right now and you know of an Olympian who is also a PDGA member, make sure you let us know so that we can all be rooting for them while they go for the gold in China. How cool would that be?
That's so awesome how much the sport's growing. I love watching. And when you see our PGA members that actually have PDGA members too, and all the musicians, like, it's so neat to see that our sport has grown that much and how many amazing people also play along with us.
What if one day we're rooting for disc golfers in the Olympics because they're actually playing disc golf?
Wow. Wouldn't that be amazing?
We can dream, can't we? On that note, we've got some Olympic games that we definitely need to go and follow, or at least I know you do, Jen. I know you follow the Olympics as closely as you are able to. Do you have like the whole streaming thing set up where you've got not only the channel on TV, but all the other channels too?
No, I'm not that big of a Olympic junkie, but I do love to watch it and I will be catching as much as possible this week.
All right. Well, hey, I'm not going to say go any one nation over another because I know we've got listeners from all around the world. So here's just hoping you get a chance to see a gold medal moment from your particular country. And maybe bonus, we'll get to see a gold medal moment. I can't say gold medal. Maybe that's why I'm not an Olympian. Here's hoping we'll get a chance to see a gold medal moment from one of our fellow members of the PDGA. So, I guess go PDGA at the Olympics.
Go everyone. Stay safe.
See ya.